Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Andrea Martin, whose book is titled Andrea Martin's Lady Parts. Andrea Martin is a hardworking character actress. Started out in SCTV as Edith Prickly, among other characters, many characters on that. Libby Wolfson was another character. Went on to be in My Big Fat Greek Wedding, 20 years on Sesame Street, several TV series, and most recently was in Pippin, won a Tony Award for Pippin. You also won for My Favorite Year, correct?
That's right.
Most recently also Working the Engels, an NBC TV show that lasted one season.
That was kind of you. I'd say five shows, but let's call it a season.
Andrea Martin, this book, Lady Parts, is sort of a memoir, sort of essays. And I want to start there. People said you should write something, and you decided to. Why did you choose this particular format?
HarperCollins Canada, who contracted me in the beginning, asked me to write. They specifically said, we do not want a memoir. And I was, thank God, because I can't remember my kids' names. So that was good. Then they said, what we want here is what Nora Ephron or David Sedaris does in the United States, a comical or humorous essays. So I thought, that's wonderful. I think I can do that. I started writing humorous essays, and then, of course, you start going deeper and deeper, and then every part of your life is then put into a story, every part of your observations. And I'd say my observations are both comedic and serious. So in some ways, it turned out to be a memoir without me wanting to do it. I think at the end you get a sense of who I am, but I didn't intend to do that.
At the end of the book, of course, there's a long segment about SCTV, the TV show, and we'll go into that a little bit later. But I want to start working around what's sort of not quite in the book. For instance, you talk in the book, Lady Parts, you talk about getting jobs when you were young and eventually trying out. Did you always want to be on stage? Did you, you know, get up and dress up in front of your parents? How did that go?
Mostly I hid out in the attic. I guess you call me a gregarious loner. I had a very, I'd say, evolved fantasy life. So I think I really felt safe just being by myself and acting out those fantasies. And then I guess my mom calling me at a very early age overly dramatic. So I guess that led to after school theater, and it was a hobby. And then without any conscious effort, it became a career. But I didn't set out like so many young people today do and say, this is what I want to do when I grow up. I really honestly didn't do that. Just one thing led to another.
This was in Portland, Maine, right?
It was in Portland, Maine, yes.
Do you remember your very first time on stage?
I do. It wasn't really a stage, but I remember performing. It was at an Armenian picnic. And I got up and danced to For Money, by the way. I hope that's a tradition in Armenian culture. And it wasn't just me, because now it feels slightly abusive. But I think I was 10 or 11, and there was live Armenian music. It was an annual picnic, and I got up and danced, and people gave me dollar bills, and that went into the Armenian Cultural Fund. But that was the first time I remember getting up and performing.
Did you sing in any of those shows that you did as a kid?
I didn't sing in those shows. That was mostly dancing, which is strange because I'm not really a dancer. But then very soon after, when I was 13, got my first professional job. And by that, I mean I work with a professional company. I didn't get an equity card, but in South Pacific. And I didn't sing in that because I played Liat, and I moved my fingers as Bloody Mary, my mother, sang. That was the closest I got to a musical to start out.
And that was in Portland.
That was at the Kennebunkport Playhouse, which I love saying because it is not there anymore, but it was so influential in my life, really. It was the first time I'd worked with a group of actors. I understood what a theater community was. I understood the camaraderie of an instant family, and it really hooked me more than any genre that I've done since then. And I think it was because of the Kennebunkport Playhouse.
And then after that, you went on to college a little bit, right?
Yes, I went to college for 4 years, but I like that you say a little bit, because I certainly, I did dabble a little bit. Oh, my God. So first I was at Stevens College, and then I think I might have been kind of on social probation. You know, I was a small-town gal looking for adventure, although I don't know what I thought I was going to find in Columbia, Missouri. But anyway, that led to a year in Boston at Emerson College, and that year led to a year at the Sorbonne in France, and then back at Emerson. But truth be known, I really don't think I was a very good student.
When you were at the Sorbonne, were you doing any acting stuff?
I wasn't. I was just studying French. I wasn't doing anything in acting. But I did study mime there the year later with Jacques Lecoq. And I think, actually, that was a very pivotal time in my life. I understood what the purest form of circus is, and how to find your own clown. And I always loved the circus, particularly Fellini and Giulietta Messina, and I idolized her. And then when Pippin came along, it just, when you allow yourself to dream, it's amazing how often those dreams can come true.
Did a lot of that come back when you were working on Pippin then?
You know, I wasn't a very good mime student, but I understood the freedom of being uninhibited physically from Jacques Lecoq. And yes, then that did come back.
Even though it was silent, right?
Yeah.
Did that kind of help you in terms of the improvisational work you later wound up doing on SCTV?
I don't think that's what helped me. I think I probably was always innately a physical comedian. I think what it did was show me that there's not just one way a career can go. And I realized respect for each kind of form, and everybody had a unique gift. I think what Jacques Lecoq that year in mime taught me was a real appreciation for people's individual voice. So it wasn't just like, I'm going to be on Broadway and be a star, and that's the most important thing. I think very early on, I knew that if you could be authentic and free, then that was the most important thing. And that's what mime taught me, because you had to be totally uninhibited to do it.
Andrea Martin, you come back to the States, right?
Yes.
How do you get back into acting then?
I don't think I ever left acting. I think what I did was just had a little blip on the radar screen and went to mime. Let me see. So I was in Toronto, and I was already ensconced in the in showbiz world in Toronto. I'd already done a wonderful film called Cannibal Girls with Eugene Levy that we improvised for Ivan Reitman.
Is that available on DVD? No idea.
I have no idea. Wow. I saw it once on television. I thought, I can't believe how good we were improvising. We did that film in 12 days with no stunt doubles in the snow up north in Canada. And we won the Sitges Award, which is still happening in Spain. It's the International Horror Film Festival. That's one of my most prized possessions. It's that and then the Tonys.
And at that point, did you already know Eugene Levy?
Eugene and I had worked on another Ivan Reitman film called Foxy Lady, which definitely you cannot get anywhere. And Ivan made it very clear to me that he had one copy in the bowels of his home and nobody was ever going to see it. I think it was his first film. It was my first film. And there you are.
Did you know any of the other SCTV people, or it wasn't until Godspell that you met them?
Exactly. Then I met Marty Short, who later, of course, we did SCTV together, and Gilda Radner, who, of course, had a very short life. She went on to Saturday Night Live at the same time SCTV started. Eugene Levy was in Godspell, and we did, my gosh, when you put it that way, it's phenomenal. That, and, of course, we're still close friends today. And Victor Garber didn't go to SCTV, but he's a very close friend of mine. Paul Schaefer was our musical director, and, of course, you know him from Letterman. The great part about being in Toronto in the 70s was that it was a small group, and we had lots of opportunities to hone our craft and especially find our comedic voice.
Were you doing any stand-up at all?
I never have done stand-up.
Really?
Yesterday, I was getting my hair done, and the young girl...
You were not
I didn't
Atlanta.
Go to Atlanta. And I don't know. I think it's okay, although it's a little dark. Anyway, I'm not going to obsess about that, although I would like to spend 45 minutes talking about the color of my hair, but I won't.
You can read the book.
You can get the book for that if you want to know that neuroses. And so she was a young girl, but she lived in Vegas, and she said to me, oh, my gosh, you look like a stand-up comedian that performed there for many years. And I said, Rita Rudner? And she said, yes, I've often mistaken with Rita Rudner, but I've never done stand-up. Too scary.
So now you've been in Godspell. You've met these people. You kind of know each other. How do you get from that to SCTV? Did you know John Candy or Joe Flaherty at the time?
I didn't know any of those people. No, somebody essentially said, okay, you're doing Godspell, you're doing television series, you're doing dinner theater, Not Enough Rope, and anyway, a few dinner theaters, Vanities. As I said, it was a small circle of people in the business, and someone just approached me and said, you should audition for Second City. You know, you'd be a great fit for it. They are looking for funny women. I said, all right, just like everything in my career, if you tell me, I will come, or whatever that expression is. If you build it, I'll be there, whatever. I said, sure, and I auditioned and got the part in Second City, and that's where I met Catherine O'Hara and John Candy, and again, Eugene, Joe Flaherty. Out of Second City came SCTV.
How did that happen? Do you remember?
I do completely remember. Bill Murray and Gilda Radner and Dan Aykroyd had been snatched from Second City and brought to New York for a Saturday Night Live. And they'd had 1 year of success. And Andrew Alexander, our producer, and Harold Ramis, who was our head writer, I think got together and said, well, the CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Company, would like to do a like-minded show. And that's when we started brainstorming and came up with the idea of Second City Television, and then the rest is history. And I mean old history.
Well, it's clear in Lady Parts, Andrea Martin, it's very clear that some of your most famous characters, like Edith Prickly, Libby Wilson, they just happened out of the blue.
I mean,
Edith Prickly, you just put on some clothing and fake the voice.
I did. I put on Catherine O'Hara's mother's clothing that was backstage at Second City, and there was a suggestion from the audience in the improv section that we do a parent-teacher scene where the parents were parents of delinquent kids. So I went backstage and grabbed a leopard jacket and a leopard hat and some black corn-rimmed glasses and red lipstick and knocked on the door of the what was supposed to be a school office. And Catherine, as a teacher, answered the door, and she said, you must be Mrs. Prickly. And I said, that's right, dear. Edith's the name. Sebastian's the game. That was my son's name, Sebastian. Catherine reminded me, however, when I was writing the book, that we tried different names. She tried different names for a week, and Edith Prickly stuck. But I still have the jacket and hat.
And then when they said, we'll bring it to television.
Yes.
You decided, okay, I'm going to continue with the character.
Yes. We all decided she'd become the station manager of the... So we brought a few of our characters that we'd done on stage.
The idea behind Second City, that era, was that in the first act you would do something scripted. People in the audience would send you suggestions. You'd go backstage. You'd have like 20 minutes intermission, and then you'd come out and do a complete improv based upon the audience. Is that correct?
Yes, it's very close. They wouldn't send us. They would yell them out, parent, teacher, or, I don't know, vasectomy. Or oftentimes they were dirty, and because people in the audience like to hear themselves say something dirty. And then we would do various scenes. We would write them all down. Somebody would write all the suggestions down. And then we'd go backstage. Of course, we couldn't do all the suggestions, but pick the ones where somebody was inspired. And then we'd go out and do maybe 35, 40 minutes of improv. Oftentimes, those scenes, we did, if they were effective, did them over and over again till they became scripted. Then we'd do them in our show.
That's really
terrifying.
Not to compare it to Pippin, but it is like working on a trapeze without a net.
Yeah, don't remind me. How did I have any success? It's still terrifying when I think about it.
I've done a couple of interviews and stuff live, and I know that when I crack a joke on stage and no one laughs, it's like this absolutely horrifying feeling. You don't know what to do. You're lost. What did you guys do when that happened?
Well, I think because let's see, how do I explain this? See, you probably are going out into the audience thinking you're going to get a laugh. When you're doing improv, what you're trying to do is tell the story, and the laughs are bonuses. So I don't, that's why stand-up, I'm glad we're talking about this. That's why stand-up was always terrifying to me, because it's so result-oriented. And if you don't get a laugh, essentially your material's not working. You know, improv's more like acting, really. So you're trying to tell a story. There's an intention. You have to get to an end. You have to find a beginning. The laughs are incidental. Now, yes, when you're doing it in a show and you're not getting laughs, when the actual scenes are written, or when I'm doing a comedy on stage, it's so much harder than doing a drama, because you are in the back of your mind listening for a laugh. It's true. You try not to, but boy, it's hard not to hear that, because that's how the material is constructed.
And then when you went off to SCTV, you're sitting, where was it, in Edmonton, was it?
Yes, we started in Toronto. And you know what? We filmed most of it in Edmonton. And I'm actually going back to Edmonton for the first time in, 40 years, to perform my own one-woman show there and bring back all those characters. It's going to be amazing.
Here we are chatting, the two of us, and on some level we know there's going to be an audience at some point listening, but it's just the two of us right now. So in a sense, it was a similar experience doing SCTV. You were improvising. There was no way of knowing anything was funny unless you looked at the other person and they kind of started to crack up.
Kind of like that. You know, most of the material that we did on SCTV was scripted. So we already laughed while we were writing it. We laughed while we were brainstorming it. And most certainly, it is everybody in the cast, laughter, and the crew, which became our family also over 7 years, that I guess egged us on, and I guess became our cheerleaders. But I think we knew certainly when we went out there that the scenes were going to be funny, because we'd already done the checks and balances in the writing room.
I know on Saturday Night Live, they sometimes didn't really care that much if they broke character because it was live. But you're taped. You couldn't break character, right?
Well, I think we might have, but those weren't what we kept. No, I don't think that's... You know, I think by the time we got to... You know, we wrote in chunks, right? So Saturday Night Live, or SNL, I guess it's called now, they have to write weekly shows. So we wrote in chunks. We'd write over 3 months. So by the time we actually were doing the show, we had rehearsed it. It became like little plays. So it wasn't so much that we were trying to break each other up. I don't think that was our intention. We did wraparounds. We were trying to create stories. So we were trying to make you believe that the characters were real.
Yeah. Which is very different than Saturday Night
Live. Yeah,
a little bit.
It's,
you know,
100%.
It's whatever.
Exactly. And that has its own benefits, too. I think the audience is in on it. They feel like they're collaborating on SNL. They feel they're in on the joke. So it was slightly different.
Did you ever try out for SNL?
I never did. No. And I was never asked to do it. It's one of the real... Oh, I wouldn't say disappointments, but I kind of scratch my head sometimes. I think I missed out on it. It would have been fun to have done, and terrifying also.
You were a natural.
Yeah, I don't know why it didn't happen.
And Martin Short was on it.
Yeah, Marty was on it. Yeah. I don't know. Who do you know? Who do we talk to? Is it too late? What's the age limit on hosting?
I don't know.
Andrea, can I be wheeled out? All right.
You're listening to an interview with Andrea Martin, whose book is titled Andrea Martin's Lady Parts. Andrea Martin is also touring, I guess, with Pippin.
Wow, that's a scary word. Please don't use that. The last time I toured was the only time I toured was my very first show where I got my equity card in You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. To me, touring is for young people who are flexible. I don't think I'm already like, I need a new pillow. Where's the toast when I, you know, I'm the worst person. I'm only doing it in San Francisco and L.A. That's it.
At the same time, I mean, financially, you're getting a per diem, so you don't have to spend any of the money that you earn, right?
I guess that's true, but you get per diems doing movies, too.
Really?
Yeah. Yes, I think. I have, what do you call a per diem? $50? I'm happy with anything. You give me $1 for coffee, I think I won the lottery.
Before we move on, one other question, political question. During the days of SCTV, were there political issues that came up How did you deal with controversial political issues? Did you even think about them?
You know, I think we skirted the issues. That wasn't our priority. And I think, frankly, that's why the material really kind of stands up today. It wasn't so dependent on topical issues. But sure, I mean, I played Indira Gandhi, but I played Indira Gandhi in a parody of Evita, and Marty played Pierre Trudeau. But it wasn't our place, nor our mandate, or our desire, really, to take on political issues.
Do you think that's had something to do with the fact that you were in Canada rather than the United States?
No. I think it's because we weren't live. We were, you know, taping, and we were writing for months. And by the time we finished the writing, those topical issues were over. So I think we stayed clear of them.
John Candy, you talk about what a great guy he was. He was exactly, in real life, the person that we saw on TV, right?
100%. Who you thought he was is really who he was. It was amazing. Very little filter.
But it was kind of like, I guess, everybody's favorite Big Bear or something.
You know, people, I think I mentioned this in the book, but I'm happy to mention it again. When I go to Canada, particularly in Canada, you know, grown men will come up to me and they'll start talking about John, and then their eyes will fill up. He touched so many people. I think everybody that saw him, really. And maybe it's because he didn't have a filter. You don't know what makes people gravitate towards other people. You know, he was a pure clown, right? He could break your heart and make you laugh at the same time. He did everything in a big way. Everything. And maybe that magnanimousness, if that's a word, attracted people. And he's also deeply generous and kind. I think that's why people loved him.
How come Rick Moranis hasn't done much for the past several years?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I asked him that a few months ago. I hadn't seen Rick for a while. I was really curious. So we sat down on a park bench, because when I was writing the book, I really wanted to reach out to him. And he's really been, after SCTV, really, he did a couple of movies. His wife died when she was very young, when his children were 1 and 3. Two things. I think it was his goal to raise his children, for both of them, actually. And he did it in a very singular way and very committed. And two, I don't think he really, really loved performing. I think he loves writing. And he was a genius, and I worked a lot with him. But I don't think it's really – that's what he said to me. He said, I don't really love it.
Is he remotely aware of how classic his performance is in Little Shop of Horrors?
I don't think he gives it much thought. I don't think he gives show business much thought. It's really interesting sitting and talking with him. I think he kind of fell into it. I don't think it was ever a goal of his. He was a writer, and he was way ahead of his time doing disc jockeys before DJs were even, you know, MTV. It was phenomenal. But as I said, he just kind of fell into it. I don't think he really felt that he was part of SCTV, which is amazing because he was there for a very short period, but his impact was grand. And I don't know. I certainly missed him.
The Canada bit.
Doug and Doug and Bob McKenzie. Yeah.
Right.
No, he was brilliant, a genius, but it's not something that he misses in his life.
Andrew Martin, when that ended, you became a character actress. I went on IMDb, and the list of the things you've done has been amazing. What's remarkable, and what I didn't catch and didn't know really, and we'll get to Broadway in a second, but what I didn't know was how much voice work you've done. You've done a tremendous amount of voice work.
Do you know, I'm going to say I haven't. And I'm going to tell you that I think IMDb is crazily misleading. So here's what, because honestly, I wish I did do more voice work. What I think they put on, and I don't know who does it, some mysterious person. It's like Wizard of Oz. Who the hell puts those things on there? Or Wikipedia. I don't know. Anyway, you know, I've done like one voice or one line on one animated show, and then they put it on IMDb, and it looks like I've done millions. But, you know, I've lived 67 years, so I've done a few over the years. But it's not like that's become my life. Here's what happens with IMDb. They don't put any theater in there. So you look at it, and you think, oh, she's a voiceover artist. I look at it and I think, huh, I'm a voiceover artist. I'd kill to have a booking.
Well, you did do several movies, the best known of which I think is My Big Fat Greek Wedding, though some of us love Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
Oh, I love that movie. That was so cool. I'm so glad that John Cameron Mitchell finally got his due with this big success that Neil Patrick Harris, you know, played Hedwig. And I love that movie. That movie made me feel really cool. You know, I'm a little conservative Armenian gal from Portland, Maine. What do I know about hip or underground? And so I felt baptized, I guess, into the world of hipdom. Anyway, I love John Cameron Mitchell, and I love that movie. I think it was really underrated, underseen. In My Big Fat Greek Wedding, there's going to be a sequel. We're going to do it in 2015, so I'm happy about that.
Your Broadway career began with a musical, My Favorite Year.
Yeah.
How long did that last on Broadway?
For a few months. I want to say 3 or 4. Wow. Not very long.
A few years ago, I interviewed Carol Channing.
Yeah.
You ever meet her?
No. No, but, wow, the legend.
Absolute legend.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, she said that sometime during the rehearsal or out-of-town period, when a show comes together, mm-hmm. it's like this little switch turns on and everyone knows it. So let me ask you first, did that happen with, say, Pippin, when you were working on it, that there was a switch where you could finally go, we know this is going to work? And that's the first question. The second part is, when a show isn't working, mm-hmm. how quickly do you know?
Well, those are great questions. And I bet you every actor will give you something different. We were previewing Young Frankenstein, Mel Brooks's Young Frankenstein, in Seattle. And every night was a rock concert. My God, people stood at the end immediately. Laughter, you couldn't get them to stop laughing. We thought we had a huge hit on our hands. Then we went to New York, and it got very bad reviews. And we were shocked, really. We thought we had a big hit. With Pippin, I had no idea what it was going to be, but the beautiful part of Pippin was that I had no expectations. I'd learned my lesson. I learned that you be in the moment, you do the best you can, and then you really have literally no control over what people think. So that was a huge gift that they loved it. I literally had no idea how Diane Paulus was going to bring acrobats from France and Montreal together with Fosse dancers, together with character actors, together with legit Broadway singers. How the hell was she going to make this 1970s musical work? And miraculously, it came together. So I don't know if you really know.
Well, you're only in a couple of scenes, right?
Yes, 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 but I...
You have the big showstopper.
Though. Well, yeah, that was nice. I certainly didn't expect a standing ovation in the middle of the show. That never happens, yeah.
Well, it happened to Irene Ryan, too, I guess...
Did she get a standing ovation?
Well, you know, from what I heard, she was the absolute star of that show. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, it's a great part, that's for sure, yeah.
And Candide, which I saw, that show was not a very good production. At what point did you sense that something was amiss, and how do you sense that?
Yeah, I did sense that from very early on, because I felt that, gosh, I felt that it just felt a little unfocused to me. And also, Hal Prince had done a beautiful version of Candide many years before that I saw.
In 73, yeah.
That's right, that I saw that was in a thrust stage. I'll never forget it, actually. So part of it was, I don't know if he was invested in it 100%. I'm not sure why it was done. Garth Drabinsky was our producer. He really wanted to see it done. There were, I guess, a couple of reasons why it didn't work. It seemed not focused, and that could have come from the direction. It could have come from the crazy huge set. It could have come from timing. I don't know, but it didn't work, and I knew it from early on.
Well, you were fine, and you want to sing a little of the beginning?
But, you know, even though you think something might not work, I have to say this, and this really is true. you have to go out as an actor and believe that it's working and believe that you love it. And I did love playing the part. You have to give it your all because you never know how something's going to turn around. So it goes like this. I was not born in Rovno Gubernia. My mother came from sunny Hispania. And now I'm here, I'm dancing the tango. Die-di-die, I am so easily assimilated. Okay, if there are any musicians out there or Broadway people, they're going to know how crazily over the map I was tonally. That was so, I was not remotely singing how it should be sung. It gives you a little idea.
But at the same time, you get the, you know,
you
I
get
mean,
the gist.
You get the gist. And when you're on stage, I think it's the gist that's most important.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen a lot of singers who can't sing on stage, and they put it over.
Yeah.
You know, Lauren Bacall in, you know, Woman of the Year. I mean, she couldn't sing a note, you know.
Well, she, you know, it wasn't the kind of singing you're used to in Phantom of the Opera, Les Mis, or those kind of shows where, you know, it's all about the singing, less about the characters, that is for sure. Lauren Bacall was the, may she rest in peace, what an extraordinary performer she was. That was the time of character actors. There aren't many shows that demand that anymore.
Well, that's because most shows are designed on, I guess, by a machinist. It sometimes
feels. Yeah, and sometimes movies or Disney or, yeah.
Well, both of us grew up in love with the Broadway theater and seeing a lot of theater. As a viewer of theater and someone who participates, what do you see about theater today? I mean, it seems to me, my opinion, that these days, some of the best work is being done regionally and not necessarily in New York.
Well, I haven't been around regionally. Pippin got it started ART, which is certainly the Harvard Repertory Company. I think there's some wonderful things being done on Broadway now. Maybe to your point, they're being done off Broadway. It's very hard to keep a play alive now unless it has a huge star, a huge movie star. It's a commercial entity like Motown or, it's hard. I mean, I did Exit the King with Jeffrey Rush and Susan Sarandon and Lauren Ambrose, and that was an Ionesco play. You know, starring, thank God, starring movie stars Susan Sarandon and Jeffrey Rush, because they don't make a more esoteric than Exit the King. And that was a huge success, and people got to see Ionesco in a beautiful production thanks to Jeffrey and Susan. So in some instances, that really works. People get to see beautiful plays because of stars.
Well, the most recent show you were in was Act One by Moss Hart, right?
Exactly. Now that's I love talking about that because the Lincoln Center in New York City, Lincoln Center Performing Arts and Andre Bishop, you know, they're the last game in town, really, that will do plays that don't need stars, although Tony Shalhoub was the star of it. And he's certainly a well-known entity and a gorgeous actor. But the Lincoln Center will take risks on new plays. And really, they're really the only place that will do it. And full huge, expensive productions. And I was so honored to be in that, work with James Lapine and bring those characters to life, B. Kaufman. It was amazing.
When you're coming into a show after it's been on Broadway for a while, like Fiddler, did they ever try to say, you know, you're the second person, you need to imitate the first. Did they say with Golda, hey, you know, you're Andrea Martin, do whatever you want?
I love that you're asking that question because I will never do that again. It's the only time I ever did that. But I figured Fiddler on the Roof, those parts have been played. Golda and Tevye have been played by many, many different actors. So one, I learned that it's very hard going into something when there's already a company intact. But two, no, they allowed Harvey Fierstein and I to find our own way and put our own stamp on it. And no, that would have been a disaster for me if anybody had told me this is what you have to fit into. And I knew in the beginning that's not what was going to happen.
How was working with Harvey Fierstein?
I had a lot of admiration for him because, you know, you've heard him speak and sing and that's an iconic part, and he was Harvey. You know, nobody sounds like Harvey, right?
Right, yeah.
But he took a lot of challenges to infuse his personality with Tevye's, and I thought he did a very admirable job. Yes.
Andrea Martin, you have this long and distinguished career, character actress. You've been on television several times. You still have to audition.
I do. I have to audition for television and sometimes for film, but very, very rarely for theater, thank God, because it's hard. But it used to be that I didn't like it. Now I have more confidence. But now I like the excitement of going in and showing someone what I'm going to do with a part. And now when I go into an audition, I never think I've got to prove myself. What I think is, this is going to be a great collaboration. What would you like? This is what I can bring to it. Let's do this together. And I use that 15 minutes as fun.
How does it feel if you overhear someone saying, you know, what we need for this role is an Andrea Martin?
I don't think I've ever heard that. That would be a nice compliment. Gosh, an Andrea Martin type. Wow, maybe you really made it when you hear that. I'd like to actually get the part before we get to that chapter.
We need an Andrea Martin part. No, Andrea, you're not the right for it.
You're not right.
Friend of a friend of a close friend of mine is best friends with Sarah Jessica Parker. He was involved in show business, and he quit when he noticed that she was freaking out, that she thought she'd never get another part. And he kept thinking, if Sarah Jessica Parker is that insecure, what the hell am I doing in this business? Does that make sense to you?
Of course it makes sense. Well, you know, look, everybody's got their baggage. It's not just Sarah Jessica Parker. But I don't know many actors who are Mahatma Gandhi or Deepak Chopra or, I don't know, Pema Chodron or any of these zen out at peace with themselves, authentic. I don't need to prove anything. I am who I am. I'm accept who I am. I love who I am. I don't know. It seems to me that that goes with the business, the self-doubt, I guess.
If you're rejected to a part for a part, do you take it personally at this point? You just kind of go, well, you know, whatever, they're looking at someone else, it's fine.
Oh, gosh. Oh, I wish I could do that. I'm not going to lie. It's, you know, yes, maybe I could have done it differently. Maybe my accent could have been differently. Why are they going with somebody like this? Sure, I have instances of that. Absolutely. But then I get over it. You know, when I was younger, it affected me for a long time, but or might have affected, would carry over into the next audition. And I think, oh, gosh, the last people didn't like me. I really try not to take things personally, honestly, and just be grateful for opportunities. That's really the headline for me, is I'm grateful. Listen, I'm 67, and the fact that I'm still having opportunities, that seems to me, I have to keep saying to myself, and I believe it, an achievement to actually still, you know, be wanted, and even if it means wanted, and would you come in and read for it?
But there's also, you know, the advantage you have that you mention in your book, Lady Parts. There's the advantage that when you were a teenager in your 20s, you were playing, quote, old lady parts, which means you were always a character actor, and a character actor never goes out of style.
I love that. Look at Maggie Smith,
who
I did Private Lives with when I was just a young girl.
Oh, what was she like?
Oh, my gosh. Well, wow. I would say private. I would say insecure. I would say brilliant. And I would stand in the wings and look at her and Brian Bedford every night and just be in awe. The way that she held the audience in the palm of her hand and her inflection, nobody can turn a line like Maggie Smith. Nobody. It's extraordinary. And she was doing it. She was in her 40s then, I guess, because I was in my 20s playing Sybil. Wow, was I miscast in that. I still remember the first line, Ellie. I remember that the first reading. Because I was playing the Candide, the old lady in Candide at Stratford, and they wanted to put me in another part. So they gave me the part of Sybil. Hello. And I had to do a British accent. And I remember the first reading, I went, Ellie, dear, do come out. The boat's on the water. And the director came up to me and said, this time Sybil will be an American. So I guess I could have taken that personally. Oh, God. Anyway, but in Act One, I had to do a British accent, and I got there, finally. See, that's what I mean about opportunities, you know. That could have destroyed me for life. Hey, listen, I'm about to do Noises Off at the Roundabout in New York.
That's
and
scary.
I can't wait for the part that Dorothy Loudon made famous. I love the part. But I have to be British in the whole thing. So I'm, like, taking – it's not till a year from now, and I'm already taking classes.
I interviewed the author of Noises Off, and he said it's an interesting show because when it's working, you're laughing hysterically. He said he once saw a production, Michael Frayn said he once saw a production in somewhere in England, and he said the timing was off. Not a single person laughed in the entire show.
Yeah.
It requires absolute perfect timing.
Yeah. Farce is hard. Precision. Yeah. I did a farce. My life has been a farce. I feel like that was a perfect transition? It hasn't been, though.
I did
Betty Summer Vacation with Christopher Durang. You know what's so great about a farce? That your intentions have to be so specific. The stakes have got to be so hi. You can't do a farce and just kind of be ambivalent about why you're on stage. And so it's very exciting and exhausting to play for an actor, but I love it, actually. I love it. I love it when I know what the stakes are and then I can go after them.
When you're playing comedy, which you do a lot of, you know, sometimes I think people tend to mug in comedy, but it seems to me that mugging doesn't work most of the time. And if you're a serious in comedy, you say your lines and you do everything like you're supposed to. You don't play it as if I'm trying to be funny.
Yeah, no. Well, I think Maggie Smith is a great example. I mean, she gets a laugh on everything she says. And you might even know she's going to get the laugh. But she does it with a twinkle in her eye. She never mugs. She's always in character. You always know what the intention is. But there's some little, it's almost like it's a connection between you and the audience. There's something mischievous about it. It's kind of unspoken. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's, you know, Robin Williams had that too. You knew it was going to be funny, but there was always a level of danger. You didn't quite know what it was going to be that was funny, but you knew that he was going to. And that's what Maggie Smith is. You don't quite know where she's going to go, but you know she's going to deliver. That's the most exciting comedy.
And when you're on stage playing opposite someone like that.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's almost, I don't want to say scene stealer because it's their scene.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
What kind of vibes do you get? Does that pump you up?
You know, Nathan Lane is a close friend of mine. He's also a brilliant comedian, and Marty Short's a brilliant comedian. I find that the best comedians are the most generous, and so they'll do their line, and then you'll do yours, and they'll just wait until you get the reaction. There's no competition. A few years ago, the cast of SCTV did an anniversary fundraiser, and we were in Toronto, and it was the first time in many years, 20 years we've been on stage together. And I looked around at all my peers, my fellow actors, comedians, friends, and I was in awe that they were still making me laugh. But there wasn't any competition. Everybody just kind of did their character, sat back, and now the next person was going to do theirs. That's what I find with great comedians.
Andrea Martin, the one other element which sort of comes around in the book is that at the time you began with SCTV, even there were very, very few physical comedians who were women. Phyllis Diller, and of course before that there were some great comedians.
Imogene Coca,
yeah. Well,
Lucille Ball, of course.
But there weren't that many. But you never thought of yourself as a comedian. You thought of yourself more as an actress, right?
Oh, gosh, I don't know if I honestly, I know it sounds strange to say this. I never gave it much thought how people were going to categorize me until they started to categorize me. So I was just working in musical comedy and summer stock, and then a variety show would lead to a movie. And I don't mean to be a Pollyanna. Really, that's how my life was. It wasn't like today where it seems like you have to find a niche, and then you do that, and that, okay. it wasn't until after SCTV where then I was just, you know, she's a sketch performer. She's over the top. She can't be real. Then it started to affect me because I thought I was just, performing and I can do this for you and I can do that. So it took many years, honestly, until 1995 when I did my first one-woman show where I dared to be on stage as myself without props and glasses and costumes and think that I was enough.
You're doing a one-woman show on and off right now, is that correct?
Yes.
What's the show?
It's called Andrea Martin Final Days, Everything Must Go. And I thought it was an hilarious, irreverent title until people started telling me in a very serious manner, we're sorry, is there anything wrong? Are you really going? Is this your retirement? I thought I better change this title. Oh, my God. People are taking it too literally. I put this together a few years ago. It's stories, and there's characters. I do Edith in it, and there's singing. I do a whole thing, a section from Broadway shows. It's kind of a retrospective of my career, and I don't do it very often anymore. I did it for about 2 years.
What brought you back to doing Pippin again?
My sons live in Los Angeles. That's where they were brought up. I have a lot of friends on the West Coast that didn't come to see it in Broadway. And also, my older son just got married in Sonoma last weekend. So I spoke with the producers and I said, tell you what, if you'll let me do it in L.A., my son's getting married in San Francisco. I'll do it for a couple of weeks in San Francisco if I can go to L.A. And it worked out beautifully. So, and then I get to promote my book and get to do a part I love and more specifically get to be really fit again because I'm in a tiny costume on a trapeze.
At a political end of it, one of your best friends, your best friend died of AIDS in the 80s. Did you get involved at all in fundraising and support for the AIDS community?
Yes, I did. I was very involved with Friends in Need in New York, which Mike Nichols has something to do with. And I don't know, I guess this was my way to help in my own way. I went to massage school so I could do volunteer work at AIDS hospices. And in fact, what it helped me to do was be with my mom at the end of her life because we didn't have such an intimate connection, but massage and able to touch her in a manner that was loving and soothing for her. She died a very painful cancer of lining of the pleura. You know, you never know where life's going to take you, really. And that's what I have to say, because I know we're probably going to end this soon. But what I have to say is I know people ask me, did you want to be this? Did you want to be that? You know, my career has been about one thing has led to another, and it's been full of surprises. And the most gratifying times in my life have been when I've had no expectations. You know, I wrote this book, and I literally had no expectations. I didn't know who was going to connect to it. I thought I was writing it for my age group, a demographic of women over 50. And I can't tell you how many young girls come and say, you mentioned things that I deal with, or young gay boys who are just coming out, and that's not part of my past, but I guess they connected with some kind of honesty or struggle or whatever. So it's been so meaningful to me in that way. And I never thought that's what it was going to be, honestly. So there you go.
Andrea Martin, you're doing Pippin. After that, you have the sequel to Greek Wedding. Do you have any more TV shows, or you just wait and the phone rings?
You know, I hope I can say this because I love these people, Julie Klausner and Billy Eichner. Julie wrote it, and Amy Poehler produced it, and I play Julie's mom, and Billy Eichner's this fabulous comedian, actor, and Hulu, which I guess is the way of the future, because I know nothing, they picked it up, and we're doing 10 shows, and I think that will be in 2015 also.
What's the name of the show?
It's called Difficult People. It's so funny. It's like insanely funny. I'm so excited to be doing it.
You plan to write another book?
Oh, really? Can't you tell by this interview I don't plan nothing?
Andrea Martin, since we have another minute, let's put on your Edith Prickly hat. Okay. Edith Prickly, what are you up to these days since you stopped being manager of SCTV?
What the hell aren't I up to? I'm here with you, aren't I, Walensky? Having a ball. Good God, you're a book lover from way back. Yeah, I was stopped outside of the studio there. A bunch of animal activists came up to me. They said, Edith, do you know how many animals had to die so you could wear that jacket? I said, do you know how many animals I had to sleep with to get it? Anyway, I'm happy to be here. Andrea Martin, she's great. Put her on the bestseller list. New York Times. Sell a goddamn book so she'll get off my back. Goodbye.
You've been listening to an interview with Andrea Martin, whose book is titled Lady Parts. When does Pippin run in Los Angeles?
Pippin runs from October 20th to November 9th at the Pantages Theater.
I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.